China is resuming approval for new game publication and sales after a freeze since this March. Homegrown games are seizing this long-awaited opportunity to get online. And before that, some Chinese games were lining up for approval by domestic authorities, but they couldn't get the green light back then. So therefore, they shifted their operation and focus to overseas markets. So I suppose we'll review how they're doing globally. But before we get into the details, there's one thing I would need your expertise on. That is, why is it a big deal that the approval of these so-called banhao in Chinese and English, I guess the translation should be publication serial numbers, for these new games. Why is this availability a big deal now?
Say you are someone who want to create a game. So you created a game by coding in your little room and you think, huh, this is such a great game. Want people to play it. Then you can do things like launch a closed data test. So you got a test, we call it an alpha test, to have people in a small circle, people you may know, or a group of people that they can play the game and then give
test
you
it.
Some
no,
feedback. It's a test. And then you pass the test and you decide, huh, I want this game to be having a beta test, meaning it's an open test. You put it onto some certain kind of platform. Everybody can download it and can play it. And then you realize, my game is really good. I want this game to be operated on a platform for people to download or to buy or even purchase certain items in the game to enjoy the game even more. And that is what we call operate a game in a public market. And to reach that point, you are going to need several certificates. Some of them say you are a legitimate company who are ready to run a business. Some say, this is a good game. It does not contain any illegal information. And the last registration, which is what we call banhao here in Chinese, refer to the application for the publication serial number. If I give you the number, it means you are a legitimate game and all the content are not only legal, but also appropriate for people who are playing the game. And that is why banhao, the serial number, is very important, because that is the final yes you got before you can actually run your game in a market, having people download, play, and get revenue out of that game. That is why it's a huge deal, because we've been experiencing a kind of a pause or freeze about the issuing of banhao, because previously there has been a government cabinet reform, and the responsibility of who is responsible for issuing the serial number has been changed a little bit. So it's kind of like a little pause because of the structural change. But now the government organ is saying, yeah, we're ready. We got everything covered. Now we are ready to issue the banhao again. But we have experienced this little pause. And for some game companies, they decide, well, I've already completed the research of the game. I done my alpha test, my beta test. Yes. I'm ready to make money and I need the money to feed my employees. So what they did was to actually take their games to overseas market, make a little bit of adapt and adjustment so that the game will fit the taste of overseas users. And now, since the banhao is again available, they're thinking, should we come back? And if we want to come back, what kind of changes should we make?
Well done, Yoholian. That was the thing about this is, whenever it comes to approval process or some sort of, well, there is that not very favorable term, red tape. But sometimes red tape is necessary. And, well, also, I think that this depends on how do you look at the government and what kind of role they should play. But certainly, this process can be quite long-winded sometimes. And Yoholian, you managed to guide us to skip the really time-consuming trivialities and we manage to get here eventually. So this is the process we're talking about. And potentially this is affecting the revenues of major companies in terms of millions, hundreds and thousands of millions of yuan and sometimes US dollars. So I suppose since March, these gaming companies in China, they've been really putting their necks out and watching every signal and been waiting about the new opportunities for the launching of new games and all that. And finally, towards the end of the year, we see that the reshuffle of the government has finalized and a game plan, so to speak, is out. Yeah, so Tony, when, you know, after listening to all this explanation, I suppose, about what's going on, how would you look at this arduous journey of approval and finally, after months, the availability of it?
Well, it must be a definite hoorah for a lot of the companies that are creating games and looking to, well, to make money off of their investment and their creativity. Mm-hmm. And I believe that though it's a long process and it seems to be very difficult to get this publication, I feel like it is valid. Mm-hmm. Because games are, and as someone who used to play a lot of games growing up, games are very important and they have a lot of information and culture. I mean, there's a lot of things they should influence, shape, and impact our history and way of life in a way. And
really?
A lot of,
mm-hmm,
yes, mm-hmm. I'll go as far as saying that because a lot of people, they spend a lot of time, mm-hmm, perhaps more time with their games than they do with physical people. And there was a game actually in the U.S. called the Grand Theft Auto. And the developer actually made the game from a game called 1979 Revolution, which was based on an Iranian revolution. And this game really opened people's eyes to a lot of things that were happening in other parts of the world. And so it's not just a gaming experience where you play, someone wins, someone loses, but you're getting an eyeful of what's going on in other countries. And even, for example, there's another famous game called Call of Duty. I'm not sure,
yes,
if anyone's heard of that, but mm-hmm, Call of Duty, you know, has a lot of similarities to some of the wars that were going on in, you know, the Middle East. And so it's all of these things are reflected in gaming. So it's not, and that's why I feel like a lot of these, you know, these holds and these publications and perhaps a little bit of censoring is in place as well, because you have to be careful about what is being released out there for people to play, because people really get consumed into these games.
That's certainly something I'm not super familiar with, but I have a lot of friends and you too. Tony and Yoholin, you both have extensive experience at different parts of your life in game playing. So by talking to you guys, I feel that, yeah, gaming can actually influence people's minds in a way. And some people even say that to go as far in saying that it shapes people's minds. And I think that's the part that people who are, well, in or out of this gaming world could become a bit wary about this idea. And during this period of so-called a freeze of giving out the approval for new games here in China, there was a lot of discussion. And we saw new circulars coming out, like government regulations or announcement about toughening sort of adjusting the content of the video games that's more suitable towards, let's say, the younger users or sometimes users in general. I mean, with the amount of violence and sometimes nudity or obscene things that happen in some of these games, I don't know which countries they're from, but I do wonder what kind of effect that would have even on an adult. So there's a lot of discussion about this, not only in China, but around the world, about the fine line of what's appropriate or acceptable, even in video games, on your computer or on your smartphone. And when I suppose the really classic gaming storyline or model is about war games, like what Tony just mentioned. And me, as a non-gamer, when I see my friends that are shooting 100 people on the screen, I'm a pacifist. And I wonder, is that actually taking the rage out of this man, or is it putting more rage in him? I don't really know. So there's a lot of this discussion about what's appropriate.
Yeah, and that's, I think that actually brings me back to another very famous game in the United States that was called Mortal Kombat. I'm not sure if you are familiar with this game, but this game was the first one that actually introduced blood into gaming. And a lot of people were really, it caused a lot of controversy, and a lot of people thought it should be banned because a lot of people worry that it's desensitizing people to violence. And like you mentioned, with certain people shooting people in certain parts of the world, it gives you this feeling that, you know, it's okay. And, you know, the blood doesn't, you know, most people, when they see blood, they get a bit nervous or uncomfortable. Yeah. But when you're watching it and you're playing it on games and you're cutting off heads and arms, and it's, you're declared the winner, it provides this sense of, well, you know, insensitivity to death and dying. So a lot of these measures to, for example, like the freeze in, you know, publication of these games, there are definitely going to be profit drops. There are going to be, you know, less games coming out. And a lot of people are going to be waiting for more games. But I definitely think that this is a process that's necessary in making sure that some of these games don't come out and influence people in the wrong way.
Hmm. Personally speaking, I feel like the whole purpose of playing a game is to be a little bit away from your real life. So if in the game I need to be responsible, I need to do my homework, answer the questions teacher raised, and compete with other students in the test, why would I play a game? I can just go to a school or, you know, do my job. So the whole purpose of playing the game is exactly to get away from your everyday life. So I don't really feel like killing fake people in the game is a huge issue for an adult, but I do think it is a problem for children if they are under the age of 18. If they don't really have a complete value system, then yeah, we need to protect them. But I think the way to protect them is to hammer out a rating system, not to get rid of all the violent games, because one of the most popular games in the Chinese market this year is a game, and the whole design of the game, well, the game's name is 绝地求生, but the whole design of the game is dropping 100 players in one island, having them killing each other until there's only one survivor. So yeah, that's a violent game, but when people are actually trying to compete for the one position of winning, they were not thinking about, I'm actually killing someone. Is it moral? Is it something right? If I'm in such circumstance, am I morally capable of making such decision that I need to be the only survivor? They're not thinking about that. They're just thinking, huh, this angle of shooting is fun. This strength would work. And if I run faster, I can get the equipment I need. So again, if you're adult, if you want to choose a game that you just want to play with your friends, yeah, there might be a little bit of violence, but I do think it's your own freedom. And that is why we can see a lot of these games here in the Chinese market, and it is okay to have such games. And my problem towards the gaming industry actually is the games are too similar. My experience of playing game is I get into the game, I started to killing monsters, leveling up myself to a point that I realize I cannot be better until I pay for some higher quality equipment, fake equipment, or virtual equipment in the game, and to compete with others. That's my problem. So I feel like each and every game, it'll have a life expectancy of 1 or 2 months until you get that point. You realize, okay, I understand how to play. I know how to be better, but I cannot be better until I pay for it. And I don't want to pay for it because so many people are paying for it and they have much more money than I do, and they are definitely going to be better. So I am crying out loud here for the game creator to create some more interesting, more informative, and even the kind of game Tony has just mentioned that has a lot of information culturally, historically, that will make me feel like the story plot is interesting enough for me to pay a little bit, you know, small amount of money to keep me in the game.
That's so interesting. And Niu Honglin, she's providing with us the first hand well, is this like tester response or a summary of the games that's available here in China? And one thing you said really struck me, Niu Honglin, that is apparently there are some millionaire gamers out there.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't know who they are, where they are. Well, they're supposedly in China. And they spend tons of money. And when they spend like five figures monthly on the game, and these games seem to be designed to encourage this kind of gamer. So in Chinese, it's blunt and simple. 人民币玩家. So,
I understood renminbi.
Yeah, it's almost, well, if it was in America, then it would be like the dollar sign users, gamers. Yeah, so these people, they come in sometimes with very little skill, but they just spend. And these guys get ahead. Mm-hmm. That's a downer for everybody else who are not spending that much, I would have thought. But I know the game developers would be very happy because they're cashing in as the big cash cow gamers come into playing your game. So that's one interesting thing that's happening here in the Chinese gaming world. Any other observations or compare and contrast, Tony?
Well, no, I was going to just say that this is actually happening back home. You have a lot of people who invest in gaming in that they will pay someone to actually give them some kind of tutelage that will teach them how to get better in the game. And sometimes they will pay lots of money. And my father is actually spending a lot of, I don't know exactly how much he's spending, but he's spending a lot of money to learn how to play certain games. And actually, Niu Honglin, he actually pays money to upgrade.
Yeah, I did that too.
And in that endeavor, you know, his skill set gets better. And I think it just really comes down to if you have a connection with the game. And I think that, you know, my father is former military, and the game has this military relationship with mm-hmm. him, and so he's able to make that connection. And that's why I think games can be very powerful. Mm-hmm. And I think that's another reason why, you know, like, for example, Japan is one of the biggest countries that produces games in the United States. And they have this, it's a bit of a soft power where you have this influence where you want to, you know, learn more about their culture because it's in their games. Mm-hmm. You can hear it in their language, the music. And so it draws you in into other facets of their culture, whether it's animation or comics.
Yeah.
So I think that, you know, it definitely has other implications that it could be used for.
Yeah, that's so interesting. And we're seeing that could be a strong point or a weak point when it comes to when you're trying to export one game to a foreign market. And we see that there are a lot of international games that are available here in China. Of course, you need to get your publication serial number approved here for the Chinese domestic market. And also Chinese companies, these game developers are also going overseas as well. And how are they fitting in into those foreign markets?
Well, I would like to say they are fitting in quite well, at least in the markets that really near ours, say Japan as an example, because we have similar culture background, we have similar kind of games, and when Chinese games exported to Japan is now being the second largest market for Chinese games out there. And there's one interesting thing is Japanese mobile game market has the highest ARPU, or average revenue per user, in the world. So in average, every user pays 1.5 times of the payment made by their North American peers and 2.5 times of the payment made by their Western European peers, meaning that the gamers in Japanese are they have this habit of paying a bit of money to continue to stay in the game and stay interested in the game. And that is something that Chinese companies see, and they think it's an opportunity so that they went to the Japanese market. But here is a little problem, because here in the Chinese market, it's more like a small number of people paying large number of money, making
sure signed players.
Yes, making sure that they are top in one server. They have a dominant power when it comes to compete against other players. However, in the Japanese market, it's more like everybody's paying a little a month, and you still need enough skills, enough tactic or strategy to play in the game. And I personally feel like it will highly affect the company's strategy in designing the game. And that is why, even though Chinese companies, gaming companies, have been doing really well in the Japanese market, they have also adapted or adjust quite a lot about their games, which cause a problem now, because now they are trying to come back, or at least having games running in both markets. They need to, let's say, make more effort in making sure that these games adapt to both markets.
And I think that's definitely a challenge. Sometimes games have a very cultural basis to them, and sometimes from other countries it's a bit difficult to really understand or to connect with some of the characters or some of the, you know, some with the, you know, the activity in the game. So it's definitely a challenge to go to other countries and be able to develop that within your users. And I think that like a simple game like Super Mario, I thought that was a very interesting game. I played that one a lot growing up, and it was somehow it was able to connect with a lot of American users. And I'm actually, to this day, I'm not quite sure why that is. Yeah. But a lot of people just really, you know, grabbed hold of that game, and it was just a huge hit all over the nation. And to this day, a lot of people still love Mario and Nintendo. And it's just, it's amazing how the Japanese were able to make a character that could, I guess, captivate so many American people.
Yeah, and the Super Mario, the guy, I don't know what his name, Mario?
Mario,
yeah,
right.
Yeah, with his iconic attire and with the mustache.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's a beloved character in all kinds of cultures. And that's when, yeah, sometimes games can really take hold in people's memories and part of your life and that kind of thing. And, well, these days we see that so many people are playing video games, and it's even become a way of socializing for the younger generation. How do you see their future growth, so to speak? I mean, are we going to increasingly be in a world when technology is advanced and the people in it are in a way dictated, or let's use the word influenced, by these games? I mean, where do you see us going?
That's a really good question. And I feel that a lot of people are immersed in this game, and they are able to play with people all over the world. And that's something that, for example, I didn't have the opportunity to do when I was younger. But for some reason, I feel like it's a beautiful thing to be able to play with someone in China or in Korea, all over the world. And in a way, it's a bit of a cultural exchange and building a friendship.
Totally. And as a fellow gamer here, I think if we make our game more interesting and inject more knowledge into the game, it can be both entertaining and informative.
Okay. And if there are parents out there looking at their kid glued to different devices playing games, I think they would like to possibly cut gaming time.
That's
myopia.
True.
We don't want that, right? We'll be back after this short break.